The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very good morning. Boker Tov, how are you?
Boker Tov. It wasn't too long ago that we were having a discussion about the Eurovision Song Contest, and in particular about someone who'd never heard of it.
Yeah.
I don't want to mention names.
No, don't mention Mukundi's name. He's embarrassed by it.
But this is the time.
Oh.
Because the Eurovision Song Contest is officially on for 2022. This year's competition is taking place in Turin, in Italy. And the thing that sort of confused me a little bit about the Eurovision Song Contest over the years is that by its name, Eurovision, you think it's kind of European or has some sort of European link. And then you think, well, Israel's been a participant in Eurovision already for some time, and Israel has very little to do with Europe. It's clearly not within Europe. And so who is this competition open to and who participates? And I think it took that step further when there was an Australian contestant in the Eurovision. Apparently, this is a competition that's open to members of the European Broadcasting Union. And I think basically if you pay your fees to the European Broadcasting Union for whatever they do, then you're entitled to participate in the Eurovision. This year, Israel's entry is Michael Ben David. He will be singing his song, I Am, I think that's what it's called. And the way that it works now, once upon a time, it was kind of a one-night shootout. Saturday night, everybody had their turn to perform their particular song. And then you go around to all participating countries. Each one has the right to rank the top 10 songs, and they get points according to where they're ranked on their list. And then, of course, the winner is the one with the most points, not necessarily the best song or even a good song, but just the most points. These days, there is a semi-final situation where over three nights, and they've already begun that process last night, over three nights, certain countries, each night a different group of countries has the opportunity to perform. Some of them will be put through to the final, which will be on Saturday night, and that's, of course, where it all happens. So Michael Ben David, I believe, will be in his semi-final tomorrow evening, and if he gets enough support from that, then he will have an opportunity to perform on Saturday evening. Of course, the focus seems to be on the Ukrainian contestant, and there is a Ukrainian entry this year. So I think that that's mostly where the sympathy vote is certainly going to go. Hopefully they might even have a good song to go with it, or at least some reasonable song, because traditionally, unfortunately, the quality of the songs in the Eurovision has left a little to be desired.
Oh, it's the best. I absolutely love it, because we never know when we're watching Eurovision if we are watching it for the chaos and the horror of what it is, or if we're watching it for the music.
I think it's the first, to be honest, and that's, I think, where the most entertainment comes from.
Yeah, that is that makes sense. The Russian ambassador stands accused of storming out of Knesset yesterday.
Yeah, there was a little bit of a story yesterday, because Russian ambassador to Israel, Anatoly Viktorov, was in the Knesset yesterday as part of the Knesset's marking of Russian Victory Day celebrations, and Russia has a tradition each year around this time of marking what they call Victory Day, which I think relates to victory over the Germans during the Second World War. And Russia celebrates a big holiday. I think they even have a two-day holiday, Monday and Tuesday, with military parades that go with it. So this is a big occasion in Russia. And as it so happens, yesterday, the Knesset decided that they also would mark Victory Day in sympathy, in support of their Russian colleagues. And Anatoly Viktorov was invited to the Knesset as part of these Victory Day celebrations. Well, what then happened was that some of the members of Knesset, particularly some of those who have Ukrainian backgrounds in their ancestry, decided to stand up and talk about the Russian behavior during the course of this war in Ukraine. One Khaver Knesset in particular, Evgeny Sova, called Russia's war on Ukraine a slap in the face for our grandparents who fought the Nazis. So all of a sudden it became a critical review of Russia's behavior during the course of the Ukrainian war. And I suppose somewhat unsurprisingly, the ambassador decided to get up and leave, which he seemed to do quite quickly, left the plenum when these comments started to come out from members of the Knesset during that session. Now, he then went on to explain that he had a previous engagement which required him to leave the session early and to go on to the next engagement. It seemed to be very well timed to be coordinated exactly with the moment when Russia was being roundly accused and criticized by various members of Knesset, that the ambassador thought it would be appropriate to move on to his next engagement. But it does, I suppose, reflect the current state of relations that exists between Israel and Russia. We recall that at the start of this campaign in Ukraine, Israel was taking every possible measure to be as middle of the road as possible, to be uncritical of Russia's behavior, even though I think privately most members of the Israeli government were quite appalled by some of the things that were going on in Ukraine. There were some of the actions on the part of the Russians, but I think the prime minister thought that he could be some sort of an independent, unaffiliated mediator between Russia and Ukraine, something which hasn't really continued. And then we had a slow but sure deterioration in Israel's relationship with Russia. Israel became more and more critical. There was a vote at the United Nations, which Israel supported, in favor of criticizing Russia's actions in Ukraine. Then we had the comment from Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, about the fact that Hitler apparently had Jewish blood, and that's exactly why it seems quite justified that Nazism could be rife in Ukraine with the Jewish blood that the Ukrainian president has, and that was really taken quite badly in general by the Jewish world, but in particular by the Israeli government. Both Foreign Minister Yair Lapid and Prime Minister Naftali Bennett came out being very critical of those ridiculous comments that were made by Sergei Lavrov. And one of the things that we didn't have an opportunity to talk about is the fact that Russian President Putin did call Naftali Bennett over the period of Yom Ha'atzmaut and actually apologized, we are told.
Which is incredible. It's really incredible that he obviously values the relationship or his relationship with the Jewish world enough to be able to do that. I was quite intrigued by that.
Yeah, I was a little surprised as well, because you don't necessarily associate President Putin with apologies.
No.
In general.
No, not so much.
And particularly not in this case. And also, given the fact that he'd been quite... He'd come out with some quite sharp comments against Israel in light of the deteriorating relationship that we saw and Israel's criticism of some of Russia's actions in Ukraine. President Putin then went on to say, oh, and don't forget that we still are looking for the Israeli government to hand over that piece of land in Jerusalem that they promised us all those years ago. And by the way, don't forget that the status of Jerusalem is far from determined, and you know that you're occupying land. You know, there came a whole bunch of things from the mouth of the Russian administration, from President Putin's government, which were effectively trying to shoot back at Israel's actions and criticisms of Russia in Ukraine. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, an apology for Lavrov's clearly unacceptable comments. They were so unacceptable that even the president of Russia didn't find them acceptable, which was, I think, surprising to some of us. I am a little confused in general about how President Putin really views Israel, Israel's role, and Prime Minister Naftali Bennett in particular. I have no idea. We know that former Prime Minister Netanyahu had something of a relationship with Putin. Even then, I had wondered to myself whether indeed it was the relationship that was being presented in public, or whether there wasn't something else going on in the background, perhaps even a little disrespect that Putin was showing towards Netanyahu. I never really quite understood, because he's a very kind of alpha type individual, Putin, and he never really shows his emotion. The typical former KGB officer who really never lets on exactly what's happening behind the scenes. And I still feel to this day that we're not really 100% sure of where his sentiments lie. But I absolutely agree with you that that apology that came from him would have been absolutely against anything that I would have expected from him. And it does indicate to some degree that there is a certain, perhaps begrudging, respect that he felt he needed to show on that occasion, just in order to balance things up a little bit.
The IDF has begun the biggest training drill in Israeli history. What lies behind this drill, and what is it?
Well, the IDF have an annual training drill around this time of year. So that in itself is nothing unusual. And this particular drill and the size and nature of this drill were actually planned for this time last year and never took place at that time due to a variety of reasons, including the impact of Corona at the time and things like that. The drill, by the way, is called Chariots of Fire. And I do love it when they give names to training drills. And in particular, Chariots of Fire is an interesting one. But it is interesting that it is happening now a year later, and to the extent that it's happening, because as you rightly mentioned, this is being dubbed as the largest training drill that the IDF has ever launched in its history, and it will involve thousands of soldiers. It will involve reserve duty officers. They will come from the Navy, they will come from the Air Force, they will come from the regular ground forces, and they will come also from reserve forces, because quite a number of Miluim soldiers, those in reserve duty, have been called up and will be called up during the course of this month-long drill that will take place, will simulate a multi-front, multi-dimensional war against Israel, war against Israel's enemies at sea, in the air, on land, and on the cyber front. Let's not forget the cyber war that has become increasingly important in our lifetime and in our generation, which is so influential. And the IDF has said that there will not be a unit that does not take part in this drill. It's obviously designed to improve the readiness of the military infrastructure to examine the ability of troops to carry out a prolonged campaign potentially against Israel's enemies. And of course, we'll also examine logistics and firepower that soldiers may face during the course of a war. And quite interestingly, a so-called cabinet has been appointed to carry out, to mirror what the political echelon would be required to do during the time of a war in the event that one took place like this. And some retired senior IDF officers have been appointed to the inverted commas cabinet for the purposes of this particular exercise. It's going to be interesting to see what the IDF will be able to learn from it. I mean, I think the idea is to try to reveal weaknesses rather than to show strengths in order to somehow improve those, to get the coordination between the various units within the IDF working better, to get the coordination with the political echelon working better, that communication backwards and forwards, which is so critical during the time of war. And of course, you know, as you would expect, Hezbollah have somewhat taken this quite seriously. Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, has released a video which includes Hebrew subtitles, just warning Israel that Hezbollah are ready for any action, even though he understands that Israel has no intention or desire to attack Lebanon. Let's not forget that Hezbollah has an estimated arsenal of between 130 and 150,000 missiles and rockets, the majority of which are currently facing Israel's home front and targeting strategic infrastructure. So that is a threat that is not to be underestimated. And alongside all of that, of course, the IDF are expected to continue their regular day jobs. Forget about the drill, the exercise drill, but we also have a security situation to manage in real time. And that also is reflected by the fact that there were some reports this morning of some attack that are attributed to Israel carried out in the Kunetra area of the Golan Heights on the Syrian side of the border, not for the first time that this particular area has been attacked. The last time that this area was attacked was in August of last year. And we understand that 4 missiles were fired from aircraft towards a particular target near to Quneitra. We understand there are no casualties, although quite a lot of damage has been sustained to whatever the target was in Quneitra. So it's quite a busy time at the moment as we head into the summer for the IDF.
Absolutely. We don't have a lot of time, but I just wanted to ask you about NVIDIA, who's the chip giant, and has a huge operation in Israel. I believe that they're looking to hire 1,000 engineers in Israel.
That's correct. So NVIDIA is a company that 2 years ago bought an Israeli chip manufacturer called Mellanox Technology, and these two companies together, NVIDIA acquired Mellanox for a sum of $7 billion, and during the course of that acquisition obviously entrenched itself in Israel even more than was the case before that, when NVIDIA was in any event active in Israel. NVIDIA is a US company that is actually the largest semiconductor company the semiconductor company with the largest market cap in the United States. Its market cap is around $400 billion. It's listed on NASDAQ. And over the last couple of years, NVIDIA, following its acquisition of Mellanox, has already recruited and more than 1,000 people to work for it. And now they've made an announcement that they will be hiring another 1,000 more people over the course of the next 12 months. They will be software engineers. They will be hardware engineers. They will be architecture, members of architecture teams, chip designers, networking and CPU engineers. They're doing robotics. They're doing artificial intelligence. They're doing a lot of interesting things. And it's fascinating to watch how people are just being hired across the board in Israel. And NVIDIA is not the only company that recently announced that they will be hiring new people. Intel as well announced that they would be also hiring something like 1,000 new employees to their campus in Haifa. So as an engineer in Israel, opportunities are really amazing.
Absolutely incredible. It is 8 o'clock. Anthony Reich, thank you. As always, we'll catch you tomorrow morning at 7:45.